Is News Corporation going to call it splits?
And we'll wish a happy anniversary to George Herbert Walker Bush, even though it might not be a party he'd like to attend. I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. Today is Tuesday, June 26th. And coming up on the show, we will check in with a tiny Mediterranean island that is asking for a bailout.
And we're going to take kind of a global perspective on yesterday's immigration decision from the Supreme Court. See what it's like in other countries when they ask you to show your papers. That's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting this morning that News Corporation, that's its parent company, is considering a plan to split into two companies. One for entertainment, movies, and TV. That's where most of the revenue comes from. The other for publishing and education. That's where, lately, most of the scandal comes from. Sarah Ellison is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of War at the Wall Street Journal, and she joins us now to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, if it turns out that the News Corporation-owned paper, The Wall Street Journal, is right about what its company is considering, what do you make of it?
Well, first, I don't have much doubt that the Journal story is valid and accurate, because this kind of speculation has been around for years, but it wouldn't make its way into the Journal with specific reference to Mr. Murdoch warming on the idea, unless that were something that were actually happening. What I think is that this is something that shows the true reverberations of this phone hacking scandal that we've all been hearing so much about.
Well, explain that connection. Why would the phone hacking scandal and all the trouble that has surrounded the company because of that mean it's a good idea for the company to split into basically two companies, an entertainment company and a publishing company?
Well, of course, what the phone hacking scandal, when it all broke open and people started to really pay attention to it, it started with a tabloid newspaper in the UK that was at the center of Murdoch's UK newspaper empire, the News of the World. Of course, that's a relatively small part of the company. It's less than 1% of the revenues, but it ended up taking over an enormous amount of management's time. It made investors, many investors, feel, why are we, who want to invest in Fox and who want to invest in the satellite businesses that News Corp owns, why are we having to worry about a tabloid newspaper scandal in the UK? And so the kind of dissatisfaction that investors have always had and have long had with the slowing growth of the newspaper business really came to the forefront.
Sarah Ellison is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, also author of War at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The U.S. Supreme Court has struck down much of Arizona's undocumented immigration law, but it upheld the so-called show me your papers provision. Of course, every country on earth has immigrants, and all those immigrants have papers. So how's the rest of the world handle this? David Bartram is a sociologist at the University of Leicester in the UK, and he's a specialist in international migration. David, welcome.
Thank you, yes.
On a global level, how unusual is this sort of requirement that immigrants have to have their papers on hand?
Well, in many countries, it's not just immigrants, it's everyone. I mean, when you don't know whether somebody's an immigrant, then you have to be able to establish whether they are. So many people in countries, even in Europe, have a formal requirement to carry identity papers.
In general, the approach in Arizona, including the parts of the law that were struck down, focused on the individual, made it a crime, for example, to attempt to work if you are undocumented. Has this individual-centered approach worked well in other countries?
Well, I would say it hasn't. I mean, that's really one of the big differences between the U.S. and Europe. And generally, the reason would be that they focus enforcement efforts more on the employers, not so much on the individuals. Israel has tens of thousands of undocumented workers and asylum seekers, and so they, too, are taking this approach of insisting that people have papers and asking people for papers, especially if they look like they're not Israeli, and locking people up and deporting them where they can.
And how has that worked for them?
Well, they've got a big problem. I mean, they do also try to focus enforcement on the employers, but there's also still enough of an incentive for people to cross the Sinai and the Negev and come to Israel, especially from countries like Eritrea and Ethiopia and Sudan.
And what's an example of a country that takes something other than the individual-centered approach?
So in France, for example, if you are convicted of the crime of employing an undocumented worker, you can get a really big fine or you can even go to jail. I mean, if you think about the way businesses, especially agricultural businesses, lobby for government policies to their liking, right? It makes a lot more sense that in the U.S. there just is much less of a willingness to take that approach.
Professor David Bartram at the University of Leicester, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Interest groups have been camping out in Washington for the last several days, awaiting the Supreme Court's next momentous decision, which is expected on Thursday on the health care reform law. They see the ruling as an opportunity to broaden their national exposure and perhaps their donor base, too. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Healthcare interest groups have been preparing for decision day for months. Bron Pollack is executive director of Families USA, which supports the healthcare law. He says he has at least 8 different statements ready so he can react within minutes, no matter how the court rules. And then
we'll be doing stand-up reacts outside the court right after the ruling. We're doing a teleconference for the media at 12:30.
Marketing guru Adam Hanft says that kind of exposure is priceless. If you're quoted, you can package and repackage the quote endlessly.
You can put it out through your entire social media ecosystem and use it forever and ever to raise money. So it really is very important to be called upon, and that's why everybody has their hands up right now and are waving furiously.
And Hanft says you don't have to be on the winning side to win. A loss can energize your base, and you can channel your supporters' anger into donations. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Across the street from the Supreme Court, funding for federal highway construction is set to expire at the end of the week. The pressure's on for lawmakers to reach some sort of agreement on a long-term transportation bill. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports delay could hurt local construction projects and cost jobs.
Congress could use some cheerleading this week.
Give me a C!
C!
Give me an O!
O!
Why? Well, it's got a lot of work to do. Pete Ruan heads the American Road and Transportation Builders Association.
There would be suspension of contracts throughout the 50 states, which would lead to layoffs of workers.
He doesn't think it'll come to that. Neither does Robert Puentes from the Brookings Institution.
It would truly be disastrous for the program to simply just expire.
One answer might be a short-term extension, which Puente says could be tough on local governments.
These are not short-term kind of projects. They take years, they take months, and there's construction seasons that happen. So there is a level of predictability that states and cities and metropolitan areas genuinely need.
Congress could also pass a multi-year plan, and there are rumors that a deal is close. One hang-up, House Republicans want approval of the contentious Keystone XL oil pipeline as part of the legislation. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
European leaders are gathering this Thursday to come up with a plan to save the euro. I know we've heard that one before, but this time things are getting pretty ugly. Spanish borrowing costs jumped this morning following the country's formal request for a bank bailout. And the tiny Mediterranean island nation of Cyprus says it needs more than $10 billion from its eurozone partners to avoid default. For more, let's bring in Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So it seems like it would be hard to say that Cyprus is too big to fail. It's not exactly Spain or Italy.
No, indeed. As you say, it is a small island in the East Mediterranean, population about 1 million, with an economy smaller than that of Vermont. Hmm. But Cyprus is important. It is a member of the Eurozone, as you've said, and it has a geopolitical importance too. Here's Stephen Lewis of Monument Securities.
Well, Cyprus occupies a strategic position in the Mediterranean. It's not very far from Syria. British have used it as a base for more than a century. In those military terms, it has enormous value.
Which probably explains why the Russians have already lent Cyprus some $3 billion, and the Chinese are reported to be interested in lending them money too. And that may explain why the Eurozone will probably be very keen to bail out Cyprus pretty quick.
And this comes right on the heels of the formal request from Spain for a bailout yesterday. It does seem like the pace of bailouts in the Eurozone is quickening.
Yes, very much so. The crisis is certainly spreading. And this bailout application is hugely embarrassing, coming as it does, as you say, on the eve of this latest make-or-break summit to resolve the debt crisis. It's also embarrassing because Cyprus, as it happens, takes over the revolving presidency of the EU next week. Hmm. As a leading Cypriot politician said, this is a tragic coincidence.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Jeremy.
Well, we've heard about the Supreme Court's big decision coming up this week. We've heard about Cyprus and all the problems in Europe, but none of that is what concerns our next guest. Julie Neiman is analyst at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis, and she is concerned about the weather. Julie, what's going on?
Well, Jeremy, it's gorgeous here. It's dry, no humidity, not a cloud in the sky. I think there's a song in this, but crops are getting cooked in the field. The big problem right now is there's no rain, and the pain ahead is that the corn silking and flower setting, it's shaping up to be probably the worst in years. One climatologist we heard of has said the planetary alignment is now what it was in the 1930s, and that distorts the gravitational pull on the weather patterns, setting us up for huge global drought.
Okay, well, bring us back to economics then. What does that mean for people as they go out and buy food and all that sort of thing?
Well, we now have over 7 billion people in the world, and they're all hungry, and there's big demand out there for our grain. Russian drought killed the winter wheat crop. South American drought killed sugar, soybeans, and corn, which means prices are really going up. We were the last resort here. We have unseasonably warm, dry weather, very early spring, killer late frost. All of this is setting up for significantly higher grain and food costs. Of course, that passes through to the consumer.
Well, of course, the consumer is also having a little break when it comes to gas prices right now, though, right?
Yeah, but that goes into the gas tank, not into the grocery cart, and that's the big problem. We're getting a break from gasoline, which does help somewhat, but farmers are still paying higher fuel costs than they did this time last year, so that's hurting them as well. So while we're getting a little bit of a break there, we're going to see significantly higher food prices unless we get rain, and that directly hits all American consumers just at the time when you're trying to recover from a depression.
Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, Jeff, Morgan Stanley has decided to allow its 18,000 financial advisors to access Twitter. I guess
yes.
That's something haven't been able to do up until now.
I can't wait to follow them.
Exactly. But many of the tweets will actually be pre-written by the bank, so they're not giving them full access to Twitter, which means you can expect more like this gem that the Atlantic Wire found from a Morgan Stanley employee who already has access to Twitter. Quote, "Heading to Morgan Stanley Smith Barney's HQ as part of my service on our firm's diversity committee. I'm proud of Morgan Stanley Smith Barney's great work on diversity. Way to go, Morgan Stanley Smith Barney," end quote.
That's a lot of brown nosing squeezed into 140 characters.
Well, I'm sure that it got a million retweets.
Yes, this is just the kind of dramatic Twitter activity that I like to keep up on. Here's something else. You know, what's good for American first graders must be good for hardened Brazilian criminals, right? That's a strange parallel to make. But do you remember when you were a kid where you could read books and get rewards? Did you ever do that?
Yeah, actually, I do remember that, yes.
I think we're about the same age, and we came of age. In my case, you could get like a personal pan pizza from Pizza Hut if you read a certain number of books in the month. So they're giving this a shot in the Brazilian prison system, where federal prisoners, if they keep track of the books that they read, they can get time knocked off of their sentences. Isn't that nifty? Hmm. So if you read, if you're hypothetically in a Brazilian prison or find yourself there someday, if you can read 12 works of literature, philosophy, or science in the course of a year, you can trim 48 days each year off your sentence.
Wow. 22 years ago today, President George H.W. Bush retreated from his most famous campaign promise.
Read my lips. No.
The first President Bush raised some taxes and lost his reelection bid. Ever since then, anti-tax pledges have become more and more common.
Here to talk with us today in our Midday Extra is Stan Collender. He's the author of the blog Capital Gains and Games. Hi, Stan. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for asking.
So take us back here a little bit, a little background on President H.W. Bush's anti-tax pledge. What was the policy, and then why did he backtrack?
Well, first of all, remember his very famous line, it's repeated, you see the clip often, the video clip often, at the Republican convention when he goes, read my lips, no new taxes, and he got a standing ovation, and it was the biggest cheer, and it was, you know, he was trying to be following Ronald Reagan's footsteps. Several years later, faced with some very difficult budget situations and difficult negotiations with Congress, he backtracked on that. And in fact, it was a line that I'm sure he's come to regret. He was out jogging, and someone asked him about why did you backtrack, and he said, "Read my lips. We're going to read my hips. Excuse me. We're going to raise taxes." And that really was the beginning of the end of his presidency.
You think that's what scared everybody now? I mean, is that why Republicans are scared of raising any taxes on anybody right now?
Well, it's not a question of being scared of raising taxes. I mean, many Republicans, based on that particular situation where H.W. Bush was defeated, largely on the tax question, a lot of Republicans have taken the pledge. They've taken the Grover Norquist-induced pledge to say no new taxes under any time for any reason in any form. That really was the beginning. That particular moment was the beginning of the Tea Party, although it wasn't called that back then. It was the beginning of the move for the Republican Party to be heavy anti-tax, no matter what the situation. And they defeated a sitting president. That is, Republicans, moved away from George H.W. Bush in droves and caused him to lose the election to Bill Clinton.
So for a few years now, that Norquist no tax pledge has been relatively ironclad. But I'm kind of getting the sense that here we are on the anniversary of the no new taxes pledge, that the Norquist pledge is crumbling on Capitol Hill. What do you think?
Well, crumbling is too strong a term, but clearly there are a few cracks. And it remains to be seen exactly which direction it's going to go. But at this particular moment, it looks like some of the people you would expect to be the most virulent protectors of the anti-tax pledge are starting to say, maybe we need to think about this. And they're starting to do that because of the realities of the deficit and because of the realities of how popular Medicare and defense spending is. And a lot of people who are saying, we just don't want you to cut Social Security, transportation, veterans. In fact, my guess is over the next couple of months, all those who have said no new taxes, has to be spending cuts, are going to be humbled as they find out how popular spending really is.
You know, it's kind of amazing to think back to that moment, that was such a big deal, when now it seems that politicians will switch their positions much more frequently, even when they're on video, saying one thing and then deciding later that they've evolved their position or whatever and they're going to do something different. And it doesn't cause such a big ruckus.
Well, if Mitt Romney got up tomorrow and said, I've decided we need a tax increase, he might be denied the nomination at the convention. I mean, that's how strong that feeling still is in within the Republican Party. There would be a massive uprising, and somebody would probably rise up to try to challenge him on the convention floor. Let's not underestimate the magnitude of how significant that pledge, no new tax pledge, is still. But on a variety of other issues, you're exactly right. Whether it's immigration or gay marriage or a variety of other things, politicians can now say, look, I've learned more, I've evolved, I've changed, and the times demand new thinking. You very often find that, by the way, after an election. That is, someone who runs on a particular platform gets into office several months later, finally takes the oath of office, and announces, the situation has changed, and my position has to change as well. Hmm.
So if we were to sneak into Kennebunkport or wherever Bush 1 is hanging out these days and throw him a surprise anniversary party for this, you think he'd have a sense of humor about it?
only depends how much gin was included in the celebration, I suspect.
Well, socially lubricate him for the exciting anniversary celebration. Well, Stan Collender with Capital Gains and Games, very good to talk with you. Thanks for joining us for the Midday Extra.
Anytime.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Microsoft is making a $1.2 billion bet on social networking. The computer software giant is buying Yammer. That's a kind of Facebook-ish site that's for businesses. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Yammer is already used by more than 85% of Fortune 500 companies, including Ford Motor.
I'm Ford employee number one on Yammer.
Scott Monty, the manager of Ford's digital communications, has been using it since 2008.
You think of Yammer as just Twitter or Facebook for behind the firewall, how employees can connect with each other in a more social way.
Collaborating on office projects without all those emails and PDF documents. Forrester research analyst Rob Koplowitz says nearly half of U.S. businesses already have an investment in social media.
If this is about to become mainstream software, Microsoft needs to make sure that they're in a dominant position in this market.
Microsoft plans to integrate Yammer's inter-office communication tools into its suite of office software, like Outlook, Excel, and PowerPoint. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Japan is facing plenty of economic problems, as everybody knows. One of those is a huge budget deficit. So the government is pushing a plan to double the sales tax from 5% to 10%, and they look likely to succeed. The BBC's Mariko Oi is in Tokyo, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Hello.
Why does the government say that it needs this extra revenue?
Well, as you know, Japan has a huge public debt. It's already twice the size of the country's economy, which is worth $5 trillion. So you can imagine how huge that is. The prime minister has been saying that he really needs to raise sales tax in order to tackle that debt. Also, the government will face increasing welfare costs because the population here is fast aging. So that's partly why the government is very keen to push this bill through.
I'm sure there's some grumbling about this. On paper, the personal tax burden of the Japanese, it looks a lot like the typical Americans, actually. How badly do Japanese think they're taxed?
Well, the sales tax here is at the moment 5%, which I should say is one of the lowest among developed countries. And this move has been extremely unpopular. A few leaders had actually lost the elections as a result of it. But Prime Minister Noda, he seems very, very determined. I mean, he has practically staked his career to raise this tax. It has only passed the lower house of parliament and it still has to go through the upper house of parliament. But it is a major step.
Some tax economists will say that once a sales tax gets to around 10%, cheating starts to become a real problem. Do you think it'll be a problem in Japan?
Well, I think I would be quite surprised, but there have been a lot of critics who say that the tax at that level will start to affect consumer spending. Remember, the country's economy has not been really growing for nearly two decades. And of course, we had that huge earthquake last year. So the economy has finally slowly started to recover. But critics say that this tax could potentially affect people's appetite to shop. So that wouldn't be too positive for the country's economy.
Mariko Oi with the BBC. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mexican voters go to the polls on Sunday to elect a new president, but in a remote hill town, a small group of Mexicans is already bringing about their own change. They're using an alternative currency they've developed. Jennifer Collins has the story.
At a bustling butcher shop in the town of Espinal, Mexico.
Amiga, buenos días.
Irene Castellanos Cruz is buying beef for her family.
Dame un kilo de costilla, por favor.
And she's paying with what looks a bit like funny money, a business card-sized bill with a reprint of a Diego Rivera painting. It's an alternative currency called tumen, a word that means money in the local indigenous language.
El tumen ha cambiado mi vida porque me ha...
Castellanos Cruz also accepts tumen at the internet cafe she runs out of her house. She says business is up 10%. Around 100 other businesses are participating, from doctors and dentists to restaurants and agricultural supply stores. Human rights professor Juan Castro Soto of Veracruz Intercultural University began printing the money over a year ago. He wanted to give a boost to his struggling agricultural community.
Pero la gente no tiene dinero.
So far, he's printed about $7,000 worth. The Bank of Mexico has notified him his currency is under investigation. And municipal official Silvino Presa worries tumen users could lose out if the money goes out of fashion.
No, es algo así como clandestino.
Andrew Lamas is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He says alternative currencies work because their communities have confidence in them.
People have a sense of ownership of their local space, even if they don't own the stores themselves. They want to preserve the options of the local.
And tumen creator Juan Castro Soto has been spreading the word, signing up businesses as far away as Mexico City.
Digamos que hacer nuestra pequeña revolución.
We say this is our small revolution with the tumen. Mexico isn't having a revolution, but in Espinal, yes.
And that's why he says Espinal will be the home of the tumen for many years to come. In Espinal, Mexico, I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Fans of college football are on the cusp of getting at least part of what they've always wanted, a true football playoff resulting in one clear national champion. A committee of university presidents is expected to sign off on the deal today. As St. Louis Public Radio's Adam Allington reports, the new system is good news for some, bad news for others, and comes with the promise of boatloads of money.
Call it a college football Final Four. Under a plan approved by BCS commissioners last week, the four best teams would play a semifinal within the existing BCS bowl games. The winners would then square off for the national championship. John Steinbrecher is the commissioner of the Mid-America Athletic Conference. He says the new system, set to kick off in 2014, is more fair because it gives two extra teams a shot at a national championship. And it would do it, he says, without undercutting the current bowl structure.
We think it allows us to do that. So we're going to be able to grow the postseason or grow that national championship playoff a little bit, yet at the same time preserve some of the things about the regular season that we think are very important.
And by important, he means insanely valuable.
More money than you can shake a stick at plus the stick.
Michael McCambridge is the author of the ESPN College Football Encyclopedia.
The conservative estimates are that a true national championship playoff could generate anywhere between 3 to 5 times of what the current BCS package makes.
Early numbers being tossed around claim a football playoff could generate nearly $500 million for the NCAA. But the plan's not without its critics. Nebraska Chancellor Harvey Perlman chairs the BCS Presidential Oversight Committee, which has to approve the new system.
I think if the Big Ten presidents were to vote today, we would vote for the status quo. We think it best serves college football. We think it best protects our student athletes.
As a member of the Big Ten Conference, Perlman's teams risk being somewhat marginalized by the likes of the Southeast Conference, home to the last 6 BCS football champions. On top of that, the complicated task of revenue distribution has yet to be hammered out. But at this point, it seems clear that the money on the table will be more than enough to buy a little intercollegiate compromise. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
In an era of underwater homeowners, this story will either make you cheer, Jeremy, or make you cry. So 30 years ago, Sherman Hines bought a rundown old house in Nova Scotia, Canada. He bought it for $15,000. Turned out the thing was nearly 300 years old. It's one of the oldest houses in the entire country. So he restored this thing to top condition. He lived in it with his family over the years. And now it's on the market. Forget this, $2 million. I did the math. That's about a 6,000% return, even after you factor in inflation. Now that is the way to flip a house, people.
Yeah, I don't think you can really do that anymore. Probably won't be able to for a while.
Not many 300-year-old houses around.
Well, finally, Jeff, from the Wow, Computers Really Are Like Humans file, there is a Google computer that's supposed to simulate the human brain. Researchers have been working on it for years. And it actually is pretty human-like. According to the New York Times, it spends all day on YouTube looking for cat videos.
Oh, what we're spending our R&D dollars on. That encourages me about our world right there.
Absolutely. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.